television nerds. My name is Anthony Marco, and welcome to TV ABCs, where we have conversations about Canadian television before cameras, before cuts, before channels, and explore how the people behind your favorite shows are being creative. This week, Eric Johnson. Eric was born in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, and made his screen debut at the age of 12, and has appeared in over 50 television and film productions since. He is most familiar to audiences for his roles in Global TV's Rookie Blue, CW's Smallville, and the sci-fi series Flash Gordon. As a child, Eric enrolled in theater school and immediately found success performing local theater productions, but it was his casting in the Academy Award-winning film Legends of the Fall at just 14 that solidified Eric's passion for the world of film. With recent performances in both Orphan Black and Criminal Minds, Eric is currently starring alongside Clive Owen in Steven Soderbergh's The Nick for HBO Cinemax as Dr. Everett Gallagher. The bold dynamic show is already picked up for a second season to commence shooting in early 2015. We'll talk about all of that and what it's like to make the cut for the New York Knickerbockers franchise. By the way, I just finished, before we start talking, I watched the first episode of The Nick.
All right,
which
on.
I am a sucker for outdoor period piece shots in New York City or any big city. Like when it really hit me, maybe 15, 20 years ago was when I saw The Untouchables, and the incredible attention to detail that they did in The Untouchables in Chicago. And when I saw a couple of those first opening scenes in The Nick, I thought, see, I'm going to be a sucker for this series now. I hadn't watched it yet.
Yeah, you know what? It's an immersive show. It'll suck you right in. And I was amazed at how many of those locations are still relatively unchanged from the last 114 years.
Yeah, they're so. I mean, you're shooting the series in New York, or you shot the first season in New York.
Yep.
So, I mean, there's got to be a lot of. So many areas to choose from in New York where you could get that street shot. I'm imagining that it's a very dimly shot show.
Yeah, I mean, but I think that was also keeping with the period. I mean, the show is very naturalistic in a lot of ways. I mean, the light is all coming from, grounded sources.
Sure.
You know what I mean? It's not an overly lit show. And you know, people didn't have as many lights in their world at that time. So a lot does exist in darkness and dimness. And that's why I also think the contrast of going into the operating theater, which is such a bright place, it shows the modern side of life that's about to overwhelm these people. But, you know, for the most part, when you're going into the Lower East Side, I mean, people didn't have any money. You know, you're not going to be burning a lot of lamps. You're not going to be burning a lot of candles. And goodness knows they couldn't afford electricity. So it's going to be
dark. I saw a couple shots, and it almost reminded me of like something that Lars von Trier would do, like that very Dogma style effect. It's like, here's the bare bulb on the ceiling. And it's a very, even interior, it's a very natural lit interior. You don't expect swaths of studio lighting. You don't assume that overhead, like in almost everything you see today, that there's fluorescent tubes up above.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that just grabbed me from the moment I started reading the first episode was how visceral it is, how tactile it felt. Like you could honestly feel the times and the texture of New York in the year 1900. I mean, it just leapt off the page. And then the way that Steven Soderbergh approaches it, it's just such an immersive way of where you feel you're not being shown this, you're being brought into this world. It's a very immersive way. It's like you are a part of the hospital. You are moving with these people. It's a very voyeuristic view. And so to shoot it in a more contemporary style makes it feel, I would say, a little closer to us as opposed to being stilted and stuffy and period. I mean, this isn't Downton Abbey. You
right,
know what
right.
I mean, this is a very honest and real look, a very gritty look at this time period and the medical profession and it's in its infancy, really.
But it even reminds me, it's scary that I remember hospitals growing up, and I'm not that much older than you. I mean, I'm in my mid-40s right now, but hospitals when I was growing up back in the 70s, you still had that sense of kind of creepy, eerie, closed darkness in hospitals. And that I don't think that's there as much today in a lot of the newer hospitals. I mean, they've done their renovations. They've tried to put more windows in, make it airy. But there's such a distinction that I noticed even just on that one episode between like a lot of the going from the interiors to the like New York being such a vast place, yet the community of that hospital seems, even though it's probably a big hospital. It seems like such a almost like a cloistered environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what's interesting is that the Lower East Side at that time period had the highest population density of anywhere else in the world. Right. Nowhere else in the world were that many people crammed into such a small area. And for the first time in human history, really, I mean, there was people from all over the world. And they were all considered free men and women. Right. And, you know, you've had other cultures and times where there was big immigrant populations but you know, this was it was very much a even a more tiered class system than New York was. So it was a very, very interesting time in American history. I mean, the waves of new people that would come over and instantly be on the bottom of the totem pole is the people who had just come over a generation earlier now look down upon them. And so it was a bit of a cloister. It was very congested, and it was very, you know, it was a very, like, you know, one block to the next could be a completely different neighborhood, but, you know, there's just thousands and thousands of people on top of each other. And you got to think about how many horses are walking the street and dumping their waste just every day. And people, you know, it was just very, very different time.
You still get some of those smells in big cities, don't you?
Yes, you do. I don't know what happens at the corner of Front and Bathurst here and
wafting Toronto. Up.
There's just this one spot. It's pretty amazing. It's a special spot in the city. You know you're in Toronto when you're standing at the corner of Front and Bathurst because there's just this smell. It's awesome.
Tell me a little bit about getting this role, because I have to imagine when you're an actor and you see Steven Soderbergh's name attached to anything, it's like, pardon?
Yeah, well, I mean, like anybody, I mean, you'd do anything to work on a project like that. Well, what's funny is I think about a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, I just wanted to put a list together. I'm like, who are people that I want to work with? Who are people that I would want to learn from and watch how they run their sets and do their job? And the first name on the list was Steven Soderbergh, just because first of all, he has an incredible resume that's just been. He's just a fantastic filmmaker, but also because he wears so many hats. He's also his cinematographer. He's also his operator. He's also his editor. So it's very much has that dogma style of filmmaking where you're kind of doing multiple things. So I wanted to learn from him, and then he announces that he's retiring from making films. And so I'm like, wow, that blows whatever slim chance I ever had of working with him. And then this comes up, and of course, you know, I read the script and immediately would do anything I could to get the job. And unlike other jobs that I've gone out for in the past that I've ultimately got, it's actually the easiest job I've ever got. And I will say that's a testament to Steven and the
knowing what he wants, I'm guessing,
reputation he has, and the fact that he can make the decisions that he wants and not have to answer to anybody else, and nobody's going to argue with him because of his tenure and resume. And, you know, I mean, we were 2 weeks away from shooting the season, and he was busy at the Emmys just taking home awards for Behind the Candelabra. So people aren't really going to argue with his choice. So I was felt very, very fortunate, and Carmen Cuba, who saw my tape, and we had a little Skype conversation after that, her and I, and she put me forward, and I think it says a lot to them for trusting their instincts, and my whole thing was, don't show up and be an idiot and get fired. That was the biggest thing.
Well, when you think about how many TV, like the amount of TV shows that quote unquote make it versus the amount of TV shows that are conceived, so much of it comes down to finding that cast. And I mean, like I said, I've watched the first episode, but there was, even in that first episode, there was a great chemistry there. It seemed to really, hasten to say it's friendly, because obviously not all the characters are friends at that point, but there was kind of a nice symmetry that was working right from that first episode.
There was a synergy. I'm not going to lie. It was very quick, and everybody was so on board with this project and so committed. And I think that was the thing that was very evident from day one. Just and it was just everybody was just so spot on their characters from the get go. Yeah. And this goes down to, you know, our the performers with one line or two lines. And this is not just in the first episode. This is the run of the show. And we would all remark at how perfect these people coming in would be. And we're like, wow, it was just perfect. I mean, it's a huge testament again to Steven and to you know, his whole team and the people making decisions and Carmen Cuba, their casting director, because it's just really, I don't want to say that not in an egotistical way, but just as a way of saying I was just so blown away by the rest of the cast and felt incredibly honored to be there and be with them. It was a very humbling moment of being included with a group like that. So it was, it's like I said, it's an immersive show. Yeah. It's just putting you in New York in 1900, and it's definitely something very unique in its perspective.
One of the things that I like doing on this podcast is talking a little bit about process. So I'm curious, when you land the show, you get the character, you're sitting down, and how much time do you have from knowing that you've got the part before you start shooting?
For this one, it was a little different than the usual. I mean, sometimes it's like you find out you get the job, you're on set in a couple days. This, thankfully, I had a lot more time. I think I had about 7 weeks before I actually shot. And in that time, they sent over all 10 scripts for the first 10 episodes.
Do you like having that foreknowledge of the character?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I feel like I'm ruined for going back to the traditional engine of television, just because it was such a, first of all, they knew what they were doing. And so instead of shooting it episode to episode, we shot the entire thing like a 10-hour movie. And in that, as an actor, you were able to see the full arc of your character. You understand where it's going and you can make a plan. And you can see, well, I start here and I end there, and you can draw a map and a line of your character's progression through the season. So it was easy for me. It's like we'd go through and I'd just mark where my character was at, and I had these little color coded post-it tabs. And it was funny because I felt like I was doing a school project, but each one was sort of each one was color coded to an event or something that was going on, and what are the multiple things playing in this one scene, and how many things do I got to keep track of, and so it was I had a very rainbow colored series of scripts, but it honestly gave me a shorthand of just being able to look at my week's work and say, okay, this is what I've got this week. And like one day I worked in 7 different episodes, and so, you know, keeping track of exactly where you are is the key. And I think all the actors had their own little shorthand or whatever that they developed. I know some had whiteboards in their dressing rooms, just keeping track of what's gone on, what's transpired, what do they know at this point, what has happened, but it was incredible. It just allowed myself to have a better handle of where I was going and start making plans and start making creative choices weeks before I get on set. And I honestly think that the results paid off, not only for just the actors personally, but the end product. I mean, it also gave us the ability. I was able to rehearse beforehand. Like get together with the actors beforehand. I got together with Maya Kazan, who plays Eleanor Gallagher, my wife in the show, and we were able to rehearse and go through our stuff and talk about it and have these conversations and that stuff. So you're not having it on set. You're having it beforehand, and you come in and you're chomping at the bit. You're ready to go. You're ready to show something that you've already been working on, and you're not just trying to cobble together the last minute because you just got page revisions and you just saw the script for the first time the day before, and you don't know how the season's going to end. So you kind of are flying blind. And this just, it felt very inclusive in the creative process. And there was just such incredible trust there from Steven and the creative team to just, it was really just go do your job and we're just going to leave you alone. And it was a really incredible experience that way.
Yeah. It's
definitely incredibly unique.
That trust element, when you hit that word, it was important to me because I was thinking, you've got to, when you have all 10 episodes in front of you and you think to yourself, that's coming up in this episode, but wouldn't it be really nice if something that I did in episode 2, as subtle as it may be, maybe a facial tip, maybe a gesture.
Whatever it was, foreshadowed it just a degree. Knowing where you're going. I mean, it just, you think you can see such great performances in films and you can see such great performances in theater. And that's because you've had the time to dissect a role, understand where it's going from A to B to C, and work on it, hopefully beforehand, before you get to set, before you're trying it out. And TV is such a machine. It happens so fast. And, you know, everybody on the department, like not just the actors, but all the different departments are getting scripts late into the game, scrambling to find locations, scrambling to find the right props, wardrobe, all of that. And it's kind of a crazy way of doing things in a lot of ways. But, you know, with this, it just allowed everybody to be so prepared and just be able to, on the day, execute their job and not have to put out as many fires.
Right.
And, you know, there's not as many hiccups. And it, at the same time, it also allows you to be more adaptable. You know, it's very strange. I mean, the way in which he, Steven runs his set, and he works so closely with his first AD producer, Gregory Jacobs, who's just, he's kind of the straw that stirs the drink in a lot of ways.
Right.
They're such a dynamic team, and they're just able to make decisions on the fly without having to go to committee.
It sounds almost like you're painting an allegory of the show itself in terms of the mastery learning kind of class that you're taking while being on the show.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, you think about the subject matter, and it's all about solving problems. It's all about finding a better way to do things. It's about moving, not doing things because that's the way we did them for the last 50 years. And in so many ways, we do so many things in the filmmaking process that are just completely antiquated. And we do it because that's the way we've always done it. Which to me is always the worst answer you could give. If somebody says, well, why do we do this? And well, it's because we've always done it that way. It means nobody's doing the critical thinking skills to say, well, maybe we could actually do this better. You know, we're just like any industry, the film industry is very resistant to change. And I will say this about Soderbergh is he's been very progressive about change and change of operating procedures and how to do things differently. And, I mean, when I first saw the schedule for the show, because that was the other brilliant thing, is we got our schedule before we went to camera, and I knew what my schedule would be for the next 4 months, is that I looked at him and said, this is impossible. There is no way we're going to be able to shoot this show in 73 days. Because that's, you got to think, that's like the equivalent of doing seven-day episodes on a TV show, which I've done before, which you're just flying, and you're not really having any time to do anything. And I'm like, and it's a period show. And we've got prosthetics, and we're going to have horses and characters and background performers and all this complicated stuff. This is going to be impossible.
And this isn't a show where you have like 2-3 second cuts.
No.
Right? It's not like you can do the quick take here, quick take here, quick take here.
No, absolutely not. And it's complicated stuff. And I'm like, there's no way we're going to get this done. And not only did we get it done, but our average camera day was 10 hours, which is 2 hours shorter than normal. And so it was an incredible learning process for me. I honestly think I'm ruined. I think part of me is just going to be ruined, and because it's such a gift. I remember reading an interview with George Clooney, and they were talking about, I think this is right before he went and did Good Night and Good Luck as a director. Mm-hmm. And they said, so what have you learned from your last directors in terms of stepping behind the camera? And he says, it's not a fair question because the last 9 films I've done have been with Steven Soderbergh and the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
And he goes, I'm spoiled. I'm completely ruined because they just, and I understand why he's saying that now on the Soderbergh front, because it's just, I was warned by the second AD. He says, just know your lines and you have the best time of your life. And it's true. It's pretty remarkable.
Now they've already quick renewal on the show for next season, which has got to be nice.
Yes, I mean they renewed it before we aired, which was I think that was the first time in because HBO
like
is
a month before. On July 10th, they already renewed it for season two.
Which is pretty amazing, hey? But, you know, they had already seen everything. They knew what they had. And I think, you know, it's a big push for Cinemax to brand itself as a place. They've been doing it with Strike Back and Banshee, and this is a big push with some high pedigree behind it. And it's a big push for them. And I know HBO, everybody seems very happy. And it's a pretty remarkable show. And, you know, if you watch more than the first episode, by the time you start getting into episodes 5, 6, 7, and 8, it's something else.
I put it this way. As soon as I saw the shots of New York City, I knew I was going to get sucked in. I knew it was dangerous. And
yeah, it sucks you in pretty quickly, huh?
It does. What we normally do on this show, because we're maybe going to jump off of the Nick and talk a little bit about some of the past few years. Contemporary studies, and Eric Johnson will be coming up soon after this. But every week on the podcast, we do what's called the beverage update. And I normally do that with Diane and Greg when we talk about the newsier parts of Canadian television. But we like to do it on this too. So you told me beforehand that you did have a beverage at the ready.
I do. I have a beverage at the ready. This is a favorite in the Johnson house. It is a beverage called a Dark and Stormy. Ooh. And we have a 7-year aged Jamaican rum, and it is made with a homemade ginger syrup and some sparkling water and a splash of lime, and it's absolutely delicious.
Wow. What brand of rum is it? Do you know?
A Floridicana. Okay.
See, we got to have those details, because, you know,
people... There you go. Yeah, it's lovely. Maybe, I hope it's from Jamaica.
Let's just say it is.
Florida Cana rum. It's Nicaragua, I'm being corrected.
Oh.
Nicaragua. But it's delicious, and it's a favorite here in this house. Knowing I was going to be on the show and needed a drink update and something to talk about, this is the classic that you can enjoy when you come for dinner at the Johnson house.
Well, I appreciate you having the beverage at the ready. I am very happy, because this I'm a big bourbon collector.
Nice.
I've got 55 different bourbons in
holy smokes.
And I just found it's hard in Ontario with our limited liquor outlets to find something.
Yeah, you don't have a huge selection. Yeah. You got to travel.
Yeah, and
that.
I did. I was down in Kentucky this summer, and I brought 22 bottles back. So it was.
Oh my goodness! Yes, you did.
I did. But I found Blanton's, which if you don't know what that bourbon is, it's the round bottle with the horse on the top, the kind of pewter looking horse. And
I have heard that this is an incredible bourbon. And in fact, a writer friend of mine, Will Pasco, a Canadian boy, Toronto boy, who's now working on a show called Da Vinci's Demons down in L.A., he was looking for a bottle of that everywhere, because he was going to give it to a showrunner he was working with, who was his drink. So I've heard nothing but good things
about
this.
This one, I'm just trying it for the first time. It's Blanton's Gold. It's only made for export. So it's made in Kentucky, but you can't buy it in the States.
Wow.
So they sell it at outside of the U.S. and a lot of duty-free stores. It ain't cheap. Any type of new bourbon I can get, I like to get. It's a bourbon that tastes, it's got a very heavy rye taste to it. So not bad. Mm. It kind of reminds me of Canada almost.
There you go.
So that's our beverage update. Now I do want to say this. I do want to say, looking back at the canon, so to speak, of Eric Johnson, you're doing the medical show. You've done the superhero show. You've done the cop show. I believe you're ready to retire.
maybe that's it for me.
I mean, you pretty much run the canon and the gauntlet. I do want to say, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I was way too old to get into Smallville when it was on. I'm 45 years old now. So when it came on, I was way too old, but you know what? It was the sucker for superheroes. And when I couldn't believe, when I looked back at your history, that you were on there for like two full seasons, or was it a full season or a couple seasons?
It was a season and a bit. I think I did the first full season, and then I think two or three episodes after that
show, I think, ushered in so much of what's happening on TV right now, Arrow going, like Arrow, Gotham, The Flash, all of that stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like
absolutely.
Showing that a show could run for 10 years, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it was 10 years. And, you know, that's amazing. And at the time when we were about to, we were about to come out, this would have been when the first Spider-Man, Tobey Maguire's right. Spider-Man, was about to come out. And so this was the front edge of the superhero storm that we are now in the middle of. But this was the first sort of wave that was coming at people, and it really, I think it really tapped into something. I mean, it's a pretty legendary property, yeah. And it's, you know, the whole thing, the series is the one big elongated origin story, which is fascinating stuff. Yeah. It's the stuff that, you know, those are the stories that we love about superheroes, yeah. And how are they created?
And it nailed the perfect demographic for that time, hit the mm-hmm. right audience. You had all of the people who, I mean, the show wasn't targeted towards people in their 30s and above necessarily, but those are the people who had that fond nostalgia for it.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So they were watching it. Plus, you had this whole new generation that came up through that show.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was pretty incredible. And the thing is, like, when we did the pilot, I think we had a 28-day shoot for the pilot, which is it's crazy. But there was big stunts. There was big stuff on television. It had some spectacle and size, and it felt like a comic book at times. It felt like the superhero right. world. And, you know, I was 21 when I did the pilot, and, it was pretty awesome. Yeah. It was a pretty awesome experience and, you know, getting to be part of the Superman mythology for a little while. I mean, people hated my character, and this was my first, foray into looking at internet chat rooms is what they were saying about the show, and I learned a whole bunch about how passionate yeah. fans can be. But
if they hate your character, then you're doing your job.
Well, that's what I said. You know, it's like, if they hate me, then that's right, because you're not supposed to love me. And but yeah, I've been very fortunate. I mean, man, this is the only job I've ever had, and I've been very, very lucky. To keep working. Again, I've done the cop show. I'm doing the doctor show. You know, did the superhero show. I don't know what else is next in there in terms of the TV tropes that I got to cover. But I got to figure it out.
Well, what you're starting to find, and maybe this is even though you're doing the doctor show now, it's a very different doctor show. I mean, we're not mm-hmm. talking about Marcus Welby. We're not talking about ER. We're talking about a television universe where, on the smaller networks, the cable networks, people are willing to take chances.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a demand of the market. I think there used to be, there was an article that I was reading about Danny Boyle, and he was lamenting the loss of adult movies. You know, everything needed to be PG or PG-13 right. when it was released in the theaters, and he was talking about the loss of storytelling. And you know, one of the things that I'm looking at the incredible stories that are being told on television now, these long form dramatic stories where you can go so much deeper with characters than you could have in a film. And you know, people are saying those movies aren't being made anymore. Like, no, because they figured out that they can do, for instead of making one movie for 35 million, they can make 10 episodes of a show for 35 million and do a deeper, more satisfying character study in a lot of ways. So I think, you know, what we're seeing in television is definitely driven by a hunger of the audiences to have these stories, these complex, dark, complicated characters that take time to get to know and redeem and hate and live in all these moral gray areas those areas of storytelling that as adult viewers we crave.
Well, you've been on plenty of shows which are the typical procedural shows as well, you know, mm-hmm. and you know that every episode, and I always go back to this as kind of like the archetype of the procedural, Law and Order, over the past, you know, 30 years, you know how every episode looks. You know, there's act yeah. one, there's the clever line by Lenny, there's the coming back from the commercial, and you know how all that goes. And don't get me wrong, when done well, it's fantastic. But it also really stunts, like you were saying, stunts character growth. It's hard to have character growth in that episode-to-episode procedural, whereas television finally caught up with the fact that people could record things.
Well, yeah. And I mean, that's, I mean, I think technology has really changed that. I mean, that was the whole thing. I remember being a huge fan of X-Files and being so excited when they would get like a massive plot driven episode. And, but they could only, it was like the mandate. Yeah. It was like only, it was going to only ever be every three or four episodes that something was going to move forward with the show. And the rest was going to be sort of the freak of the week. Yeah.
When you saw the black goo coming out of people's nose and
yeah, exactly. But that was riveting. And we'd wait for the end of the teaser and be like, oh, it's just another episode. It's not a good plot one. And you know, I'm like 16, 17 years old thinking this, but craving that, but there was no real way to consume it in that way. Yeah. You know, we could have been recording on VHS tapes, but what are we going to record every three or four episodes? So it's kind of amazing how, and you know, I would even say like a show like Lost really did that on the network side of things, like a major show that was so plot driven and so complicated that was so big. Yeah. And so popular and just proved they could work. And also the death of reruns. Yeah. That's the other thing that has been driving this is like people don't want reruns. They want original material. They don't want to see something that they've already seen or something that they've already, you know, it's just all about original content. So it's kind of a perfect storm from a storytelling standpoint. I think there's more television dramas on now than I think has ever been at any point in television, which, you know, people are saying, well, television is dying. And it's like, no, it's just shifting. It's shifting into different areas.
But do you think it's hurting? I can't say hurting. Do you think it's restricting the major networks? Because the major networks are probably the least likely to try to be risky.
Well, it's tough. I mean, I think you see that in Canada as well. And I mean, there is a certain mandate that they have to maintain. Like they have to appeal to a broad audience. I mean, you're not going to be being able to put a very risky niche show on CBC. Yeah. You know, they have to try and appeal to as many people as possible. And their advertisers want them to. But when you have a subscribership model, their whole idea is to drive as many eyeballs to it to want to subscribe to that channel. So it's very different. It's just a completely different business model. And I get it. Like I said before though, you know, the film and TV industry is incredibly resistant to change because they find a model, it makes the money, they don't want to change it. But I think if you had seen them be more have embraced digital streaming and that type of subscribership model, then there wouldn't have been a rise of Netflix. Right. You know what I mean? Like the industry would have provided it, but you know, stubbornness and an unwillingness to adapt or mess with a model that they feel is working is puts them behind the eight ball at times, and then they're playing catch up.
And I love, and I don't know if you do this as well, but I love the weekend season long marathons on Netflix.
Oh, how great is that, huh?
You know,
where you can just binge. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, just I got into Breaking Bad late because I didn't have AMC as a channel, and then it was on Netflix, and we raced through the first two seasons, and I was just blown away. It became my new favorite show. I loved how dark, and I loved how dark the humor was, and I loved how it was shot, and then after that, I started buying the seasons on iTunes because I didn't want to wait for them to be on Netflix. So, I mean, they're still getting revenue from me. And that was the thing. It's like, I was happy to pay for it after I discovered it and consume it. But, you know, it was pretty wild.
Yeah. And that model is so, I mean, that's literally just over the past 5 years.
Yeah. I mean, it's the landscape is changing so fast. Yeah. And look at, you know, you look at how suddenly Amazon and Yahoo are players and they're trying to attract creative talent. And now there's just so much competition for the major networks and even HBO. I mean, like, look at how many people that they've got to compete with. But then at the same time, AMC does The Walking Dead. They had 17.3 million people tune into the season 5 premiere. Yep. That's insane. Nobody gets that kind of numbers anymore. Yep. You know, not even on your major networks. And this is a small cable channel. And to be able to get those kind of numbers, and ever-increasing numbers going to season 5, is just, it's remarkable. It shows that the audience is still there. They just may be more fragmented.
I want to jump back because I want to jump even further back than Smallville.
All right.
Here's the thing. When I see Edmonton 1979, I think Wayne Gretzky.
Yep.
So how long did you stay in Edmonton up until you moved to Toronto?
I stayed in Edmonton. I moved away for good because I'd go back whenever I was broke. I would move back. I moved away for good when I was 21. Right before we started shooting the first season of Smallville in Vancouver. So I'd lived in Vancouver before, I'd lived in LA, and I did this like West Coast migration. I would leave Edmonton and go to Vancouver and work in the fall and take that money and go to LA for pilot season from January through April, come back pretty much broke, and then, you know, find some jobs in Alberta or Canada, and then go back to Vancouver, spend more time there, go to LA, spend the money, come back to Edmonton broke, and live in my parents' basement again, and did that for a couple of years. And then when Smallville came around, that's when I made the move for good to Vancouver. And I was in Edmonton for a long time. It was actually still hard to leave. I have very good friends there. My family's all there. And, you know, I grew up doing this, so it's not like it was just what I did. It was just like a whatever, like anybody else. It was just a job.
Well, how young did the acting bug hit you? Elementary school, before high school?
Yeah. I was like 9 when I started taking classes because I was terrible at hockey and my parents needed to get me out of the house for a while. So when I was 9, I started taking classes at this place called Stage Polaris. And they did acting classes for kids, and then they did professional theater shows at the Meyer Horowitz Theater at the U of A, and they would do 3 shows a year. And so my classes were like, I think it was for 4.5 or 5 hours every Saturday.
Wow.
And so I did that, and you know, mostly hated it and hated the work and hated to have to do it. But then every year we'd do our end of the year performance, and I loved it, and I would sign up again for another year. And when I was 11, I did one of their professional shows. It was a play, The Secret Garden, and I played the young sickly kid in it named Colin. And the greatest thing about it is that I missed an entire month of school. And it was like, honestly, it was amazing. And the crazy thing about it is my grades went up while I was gone, because I did more schoolwork as homework than I did when I actually went to school all day. And so I loved it. It was just like, I got to go and do my own thing. I think I got paid like $400, and I'm like, this is amazing. I just made $400. And then after that, it was just something that I wanted to do. I loved it. I did my first bit on television when I was 12. Ray Bradbury used to have this anthology.
Oh yeah,
series.
I remember that.
And I did one. I did one of those, which it actually shot in Edmonton. That was the first thing I did on television. I did a small little indie film when I was 13 called Road to Saddle River. And then when I was 14, I did a film called Legends of the Fall. And Legends of the Fall was, you know, it's a Hollywood film. It's Anthony Hopkins and Brad Pitt. And you know, I'm 14.
It was
pretty close to that. I mean, it was, you know, like third or fourth or something like that. And it just demystified that to me, you know. I had auditioned for Unforgiven, to play Clint Eastwood's son, and because I was a kid, right? And but you know, they said I didn't quite look like I was starving, and so
look at my reel playing Colin.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, it's still, because then I watched the Oscars that year and it wins for Best Picture, right? And I'm like, oh, I auditioned for that. That's crazy. And then Legends of the Fall comes around and it was right there and I was a part of it. And Hollywood didn't seem like it was so far away anymore. It didn't feel like this foreign place that I would never be able to get to. It was right there. It was in my backyard. I was a part of it. And I went, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, at some point, so I imagine, when you were talking about being back and doing the essentially the theater school stuff, it's almost like any craft that you learn. There, you bang your head against the wall in frustrations getting through that level of craft.
Yeah.
At some point, though, I mean, I grew up playing piano from when I was five, for instance, and I hated the first 4 or 5 years playing piano.
Yeah.
But then at some point, you turn around to start loving the acquisition of craft.
Yeah, I think it's hard. I was talking to I have a daughter, she's 7, and I was talking to one of her friend's parents, and she was saying, you know, her daughter was playing some sports, and it's not in the fun stage anymore. You know, when you're like 5 and you can just go out on the ice and you're playing hockey and it doesn't matter. And then at like 7 and 8, you're starting to work on things. You're starting to do the work. And it cannot be a lot of fun. There's a lot of failure in those times. Like you said, when you're a kid, hating the piano lessons. And I can remember just hating these acting exercises and monologues and doing all this work and breaking things down and breaking down Shakespeare and all of that stuff and just hating it. And then learning later how valuable it is and how, you know, you do it and you do it and you do it and you do it and you do it. And then you're not really thinking about it anymore. And you can play again.
Well, yeah, I like to say that that's when your craft becomes art again, when you have to stop thinking about it.
Yeah. And you can trust some instincts in there and play. And, I feel very, fortunate to have been able to see that through and but you know what, that's ongoing too, because I mean there was a couple of years ago where I felt pretty stagnant and I was not having fun, and you know, I was getting a little sour, right. And what changed everything is I went and took classes, and I went to Second City and did improv and laughed my ass off and met some wonderful people who were all at varying stages of their careers. Some just sort of getting going. Some people, you know, a little older like me. And it was a little, I was nervous to go into a class and knowing I was going to be one of the oldest students in there. And also who had been working for 20 years. And, it ended up being the best thing for me, because not only would I go there and laugh for 3 hours twice a week or once a week, whenever it was, but it rejuvenated me again in terms of making different choices and having fun and challenging myself and stepping outside my comfort zone. So, you know, it was, you know, when in doubt, go back to class.
Now, over the past 5 years, pretty solid, unbroken string of, I can't imagine where you get a vacation during half the time. I mean,
you'd be surprised.
you got to make the time, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like if I could work, you know, 365, I probably would. I mean, I'm a bit of an idiot. I love this. I love this job. I love the business. I love everything from, you know, prep to post production. Like anything I can do, I'm happy to do. I've, you know, done people's short films, and I'm there wrapping cable at the end of the night because I just love it. I love the team aspect and coming together and making something together. It's kind of fun. It's funny, but there are ebbs and flows to it. I mean, I've been very lucky where I've got a very consistent resume, especially the last 7 years since Flash Gordon. It's been very consistent, and I've been able to also say no to some things that I didn't want to do because I didn't quite have to. And
isn't that a nice feeling?
It's very empowering. It's, you know, I have a couple of actor friends, and really the only power we have in our career is the power to say no. Because you can't always say it. And, you know, once you say yes, you're sort of at the mercy of the show. And, you know, the biggest power we have is in saying no. So it no matter how much it can disappoint you at times, but other times it's the only good feeling we get, really. The only time we get one bit of modicum of control over our career.
I like to kind of wrap up every single episode of this with talking about the pop culture that influenced you as you were growing up, whether it was TV, whether it was film, maybe even music. Because I find that, I mean, one of the podcasts that I do is like a retro television podcast, because my favorite nostalgia moment when I look back on my childhood is Saturday mornings.
Oh, yeah. Saturday morning.
Right.
Cartoons. I mean that was like the biggest day.
Like, I remember 7, 8 years old getting up and from 7 a.m. to 12 on Saturday morning, just watching cartoons constantly. And like, that's etched in my head for the remainder of my life. I don't necessarily need as visceral a moment from you, but I'm just curious as to some of the stuff that, you know, you would always were kind of your touchstone, you know, television shows and movies and stuff you kept going back to.
I loved TV when I was a kid. I absolutely loved it. I used to wake up at 4:30 or 5 in the morning to go and watch TV, and there would be nothing on. There would be, I remember watching Ray and Tammy Faye Baker because there's nothing on TV yet. There's no cartoons, right?
Before the cartoons started on Saturday morning, there was a show called Ag USA. It was an agricultural report.
Oh my God. Of course, but you're going to watch because I was that kid. I once was up. I think I probably got up at like 3 in the morning or something like that. Turn on the TV watching, and the remote fell behind the couch. And then the screen went to snow. And I thought I broke the TV. But it turns out, no, they just didn't air stuff all night long at that point. But I had no idea. I woke up my parents and thought I had broke the TV and felt horrible. Because no, I broke the TV. But the thing that I loved as a kid were Disney movies, like animated Disney movies. And every birthday and every Christmas, I usually got one on VHS. And I mean, it sounds weird, but I've probably seen Bambi and the Jungle Book and, you know, Robin Hood.
I had the Robin Hood vinyl album as a kid growing up. And
those are some great songs.
I memorized so many of those songs.
Oh, yeah. But I've probably seen those movies 30 times. And also Tim Burton's Batman as well. I've probably seen that over 30 times.
That's actually playing in a theater in Hamilton coming up over the next week or two.
You got to go. That's amazing.
I know. It was, to me, I loved the, for me, it didn't come together the way I hoped it would. I remember when I first watched it. I love Michael Keaton in it. I love the look of the film. When I watch it now, it just comes across as too calm. And maybe it's been ruined for me by the fact that we've had some really dark Batmans. And
yeah, I mean, it was pretty dark for that time. Yeah. I remember, like, it was Adam West as Batman before that.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it was very different. But, like, those were the things. And I would say one of the defining moments for me in the theater was actually Dances with Wolves.
Yep.
I think I was 11 years old or 10 or 11 years old. And my grandmother and aunt sort of recognized, like, this is an important film, and actually took my brother and I and my mom. We all went to the theater, which was very rare. Like, my family didn't go to movies. My family didn't watch movies. Sure. This was, you know, they were busy. They were working, they were doing things. But we went to the theater and I watched that movie, and it blew me away. And that movie sticks with me. The music sticks with me. The fact that it was that moment I discovered that the guy who was in it also directed it. And at that point I said, I want to do that with my life.
Right.
I want to be that guy one day. And, but that movie will forever stick with me as being a very, very influential film. And it's pretty spectacular. I mean, it kind of feels like a douchebag thing to say because what did it get nominated for 9 Oscars or something like that? But I was an impressionable 11-year-old and had never seen anything like that. Had never seen any sort of Oscar film before. That was the first one that I had seen. So it was that was a pretty defining moment.
It's such a big. I mean, after all the dark, gritty films of the 70s. As you're rolling into the 80s and 90s, it was kind of the rebirth of the Western with a lot of films.
Absolutely.
And having the scope, the great thing about that film was the scope of it. People 20 years older than us grew up on these vast Westerns, you know, riding across the prairies and all that. And to them, even though they might have liked the story, the scope wouldn't have been as much of an issue for them. And they wouldn't have noticed as too much difference. But you're right. When we get to that, you know, the era of even Unforgiven when that came out and films like that, we weren't used to that scope.
But you know what? My wife and I were talking about this the other day, that there was an incredible run of movies from the late 80s through mid 90s where they were incredible stories. And, you know, we're talking like Forrest Gump and Dances with the Wolves and Unforgiven, and the list goes on. Pulp Fiction came out of that time. There was amazing careers made. It was the birth of Ron Howard as a filmmaker, and just amazing, amazing films that are now like monuments in cinema that were all coming out back to back.
And it was also what I like to think of as the generation after that golden generation in the 70s, like the Scorsese, the Francis Ford Coppola generation. So you get Tarantino, who was heavily influenced by those, but then brought in that scope and scale with all of the other pop culture stuff, like the samurai films and the blaxploitation films. And he just brought it all together.
But also think of like Spielberg, who came out of that group in the 70s, also in that time makes Jurassic Park and Schindler's List. And two completely mind-blowing films for different reasons. And it's just, it was actually in a pretty amazing time to be a young kid going to the movie theater. And I mean, even Terminator 2 came out, and that's just like whole new CGI effects like that still pretty much hold up. And it's, I mean, it was a pretty amazing time to be making movies and seeing movies. And it definitely heavily influenced me moving forward, because they were, those are some pretty big films.
Well,
maybe every generation says that, though. Maybe I'm just an asshole. Maybe every generation says that the films that they saw when they were in their teens and early 20s are the best films in the last, you know. But I don't know. I think it was a pretty incredible run.
Well, I tell you, you're having the opportunity now to act in what many people are calling a golden age of television.
Yeah, I feel very fortunate to be in one of those shows that people are saying that about.
In wrapping up, I always like to think there's this old Jesuit tenet which says that give me a child for his first 7 years and I'll give you the man. The idea that you know, at 7 years old, all of your core values are somehow in place. If you look back at the 7-year-old Eric Johnson, do you still see that 7-year-old in yourself?
Yeah, I do. I think one of the biggest things that I've been blessed with in my life is that, for the most part, my brain has been my own to do with what I want. Other than memorizing some lines for people and stuff like that, I've got to live a creative life. I've somehow managed to maintain playing my favorite game as a kid of playing pretend, and fooled people enough into paying me for it. And to me, I feel like the luckiest guy in the world, because when I was 7 years old, all I wanted to do was go outside and run around and play pretend. And now I get to do that for a living. And so that somewhat stubborn 7-year-old is still very much alive in me. I'm sure my wife would attest to that.
Well, thanks for listening to another episode of the TV ABCs podcast. You can find all of the episodes that we do at tv-eh.com. And you'll see a link to podcasts. And every second week, you'll get one like we just had with Eric Johnson. We'd like to thank him again for joining us on the podcast. But every other week, you'll be hearing myself, Diane Wild, and Greg David talk about the ins and outs, the minutiae of Canadian television. So hopefully we're giving you kind of that broad-based approach to everything you like about Canadian television. And hopefully you can dig it. We've got some great discussions coming up with people from the Canadian television industry. And we hope that you feel free to join us. If you like this podcast and you feel that there is value in it for you and you want to help us get it out to more people, sometimes the server stuff, the space, the serving it up ain't all free, folks. And we like to bring you the best product possible. Please feel free to give as little as $1 a podcast by going to patreon.com. That's patreon.com/TV_EH. Please feel free to do that. And if you would like to help us out, if not, that's cool as well. Just maybe share the link with your friends. You can find me on Twitter @AnthonyMarco. And now we return you to your regularly scheduled programming.